With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Punk Rock NBA Podcast.
If you are enjoying this show, and I hope you are, I wanted to mention our Patreon because that is the best thing that you can do to support the show if you are so inclined. Patrons get access to every podcast a week early without any of the ads. There's also members-only channels in the Discord that I am super active in. I do Q&As, I do some giveaways, and for everyone who has asked, there's also a way to have me review your music or artwork or anything else that you would like to get my eyes or ears on. Every month, I do a call for submissions on Patreon. You post your work in the comments, and then I will review it live on Twitch and then post them to YouTube for everybody on Patreon as well. So if any of that sounds interesting to you, there's a link to that in the show notes for this podcast. So we've been working together for about 8 years now, starting back in 2013 when Al and I worked together. Well, we worked on stuff before that, actually. But like the first real thing we did together was 2013 when we did a class for my old company, Creative Live. The first kind of live streaming music education event in the way that everybody does them now, or well, not everyone, but much more common now, but we were kind of the first to do that sort of thing. And then I did a bunch of other like 70 or so other classes, but Al was the one person I worked with consistently throughout those. I think we did 5 or 6 classes together, something like that, maybe more, which I'm still proud of. And now we work together on URM Academy and Riff Hard. Any of you guys who are into production have probably seen Nail the Mix. That's the kind of main thing that I guess most people would know. That's our company where every month we have a different producer come on to mix an album by a new band every month. You get the multi-tracks from it. And then at the end of the month, the producer shows how they do it. And you can kind of compare your work to theirs. We've had bands on like Fall Out Boy and Bring the Horizon and Gojira, Meshuggah, Periphery, Opeth, Lamb of God, Suicide Silence, like tons and tons of other bands. Al is the person who has made all of those artists happen. He's very good at making deals in addition to being a great musician. And now we have a new thing called riffhard.com, which is an online school for metal guitarists, which we do with John Brown from Monuments. So all of that is to say that if you're a musician of any kind and you want to know how to get better at playing, or if you're a producer, or even if you're just a fan who wants to learn how to listen to music better, Al is the person you should be listening to. I would credit him with teaching me probably the majority of what I know about music from like a songwriting and production perspective. If you think any of my feedback on the Patreon reviews is good or anything like that, it's only because of things that he has taught me. So that is why you should care what he has to say. And now we can officially start the interview. So Al, thank you very much for joining us tonight. And hopefully I embarrassed you with my glowing introduction.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you for that introduction. I'm actually amazed by how much detail.
I could have gone on much longer, but that would be awkward for everybody.
I have no idea what you played. I couldn't hear it, but you
played
said
Avalanche of Worms and Subterfuge.
Okay. Yeah, that I got firsthand carpal tunnel on those, actually.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What I wanted to talk about tonight, I mean, like I said, I talk to you more than anybody other than Lynn, and sometimes I even talk to you more than her.
I'm sorry.
Some days. So, we could talk about anything forever, but what I wanted to focus on tonight, because I know we've got a lot of musicians who are watching and listening, is just kind of talk about the craft of music, how to be a better player, better producer, better songwriter, because I don't know, we don't really talk about that much anymore. We talk about business stuff, but you have just a wealth of knowledge there, so I kind of want to talk about that.
Sure, always happy to talk about that. I actually think that getting better at music is pretty much the same exact thing as getting better at a sport, or like you do getting better at MMA fighting anything like that that requires both a technical mastery over something and also mental game. I think it's not just like doing a physical thing or just like doing a mental thing. So I think anybody who's trying to actually make it their focus needs to take both of those things into consideration. This is the first thing that came to mind about getting better at music.
The one thing I would say that really defines your approach to me, which I think people really need to hear, is the concept of never cutting corners. Can you talk about that a little bit and why that's such an important thing for musicians and producers to understand?
Well, at the end of the day, you're trying to create something that doesn't exist yet. It's some idea that you have in your head or that you share with somebody else. And there's really no roadmap for it besides your own standards. You know, if you're writing a song, even though the rest of the world hears it in a they hear it as it is, to you, it's all question marks. And if you're not careful, you can end up selling yourself short or undershooting whatever the target is. And in order to not do that, I think that you just need to always keep an eye on making it as good as you possibly can. It sounds super obvious, but it's a lot harder when you actually get down to it. But if you're not doing that, I guarantee you that somebody else who's also, you know, trying to get good at guitar or writing songs is doing that. And basically they're going to win the race. So I've always seen it as doing what somebody else won't do or trying to do more than what somebody else will do, which might not be the healthiest approach, but I've always kind of seen it like that. My dad he basically drilled into my head that music and sports are super, super similar on the competition side, which I think is not what a lot of artists want to hear.
Right.
Because they like to think that it's all about art and all this beautiful stuff. But I've noticed that people who don't take that side into consideration tend to fall behind because it's super easy to go down rabbit holes or not have the right kind of focus.
There was an example of that came up in a conversation the other day. I won't say who you were working with because we haven't announced it yet, but a guitarist that we're going to be working with next month who...
God, he's so good.
...is ridiculous. Talk about his practice regimen as an example of somebody who won't cut corners.
So he reminded me a lot of the drummer Alex Rudinger, who I think is one of the most gifted and able drummers in pretty much metal history. You could say that, I think. Mm-hmm. It's weird to say that about people that are, you know, our contemporaries or whatever.
Actually, but he's like almost 20 years younger.
He's about he's like, I mean, contemporaries working wise. I was just thinking, I saw him like a kid when I first met him. But the thing that I remember about him in the studio was, you know, we'd be tracking these insane tech metal, death metal albums. And most of his drum parts would be first take, second take, or third take with like almost no edits needed. And he would nail this shit. And then while we were comping a take or listening back, he'd just be practicing in the other room. And however long we needed between takes is however long he'd practice. And then after the session, which, you know, it'd be like 8 hours or 10 hours, he'd practice for another 2 hours. Before the session, he'd practice for an hour. It's just this nonstop stream of playing. And so people think that his ability is godlike or inhuman, but I think it's just an example of what happens when someone's super talented and super obsessive focuses their energy. And this guitar player had a similar thing when we were filming him. Well, in between when we were filming him, he was constantly playing. We would do like 8-10 hour filming days where he's playing really taxing, complicated, both physically and mentally, stuff that's just not easy. And then he'd go back to the hotel and practice for an hour or two. And I know that he would practice for about 90 minutes before the shoot as well. And I remember when he was getting ready, he was telling me about his practice regimen and just sounded like an athlete. It's just, bedtime, wake up time, meal time, exact amount of minutes on the instrument, all of it just reminded me of an athlete.
What about in the studio? Because I forgot to mention the thing that probably a lot of people know you for is as a producer, mixer, engineer, whatever. You worked with lots and lots of, you know, big metal bands that people know, like Job for a Cowboy and Monuments and Whitechapel and a bunch of other bands I'm forgetting. But talk about in the studio what that means, because that was really eye-opening for me to discover what I thought was pretty good was like shit tier by your standards. Can you talk about what that looks like in the studio to not cut corners?
It looks like a lot of frustrated people, basically. You know that feeling when you've been working really, really hard at something and you push past the point where you thought it was your limit, but you actually had like 4 hours of productivity left in you. And that feeling you get after that, like the actual exhaustion where you don't have the emotional ability to just be cool or be present or anything, just that for about 6 weeks straight. Basically, you know, it's gone well when there's literally nothing else that anybody can possibly give to it. And that's really, really different than say like a local band session or something where there is nothing against them, but they're looking at it like Weekend Warriors or By the Clock, or thinking that something is good enough when usually it's not. I mean, that's why you need a producer, right? Same reason you need a coach is you need a third person perspective on what's good enough. And the dissonance between what's actually good enough and what you think is good enough can cause a lot of tension and a lot of frustration. So it's a high energy, high, frustration, high output kind of environment that I don't think is, I don't think most people are suited for it, honestly.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people in this, you know, I'm speaking specifically about music, but this applies to any kind of creative field. There's a lot of people who I think would tell you that they want to be held to a high standard and would tell you that they want to be pushed because, you know, they want to achieve excellence. But then when somebody actually pushes them and they are actually held to that high standard, they get pissed off and they break mentally. Have you, I mean, I guess you don't really work that way, I don't think. You're very good at punishing yourself. But what would your advice be for someone who's in that moment where they're feeling that frustration and they just want to throw their guitar down and say, fuck you, I'm out of here? What's your advice for that person in that moment?
Chill the fuck out, basically. I mean, it totally depends, right? Because everybody is different. There's some people who maybe the best thing would be for them to go take a walk, come back in 15 minutes and do it. And then some people, they're just being bitches. You need to push them and they'll get over it. And within 5 minutes, they'll forget that they were frustrated. But I think actually it's the producer's job to understand who they're working with and what kind of person they are, and then tailor the approach to that. Because if you take the one size fits all approach, that's going to lead to people actually breaking or not wanting to put up with your shit. So I really think that it varies. A good producer will vary the approach totally on who they're working with.
Right. I remember one of the first times that we were, I don't remember what it was. It was at Audio Hammer, but I was like, here, well, let me play something and you tell me what I'm doing wrong. And you were like, I played something and you were like, well, did you mean to hit all those other strings?
Yeah.
And I was like, no. Okay. Like, and I wasn't mad. I guess what I'm getting at is like, I think a lot of people, a lot of musicians, artists in general believe that they are a lot better than they actually are. And that's a tough thing to deal with, to be confronted with the fact that like, actually you're like five notches worse than you believe you are. Because they've never been held to that standard.
How would they know, too? Right. That's the thing.
Compared to the other people in local bands, they're probably great.
Probably.
But compared to the best, they suck.
Yeah, I remember when my dad came to see my local band when I was in high school. We just finished playing a pretty good show. I think we brought like 100 people or something. And
like, ale, that is not very good.
Yeah. No, yeah. I was like, didn't you think we were good? And he's like, it's not very good. And it's like, but we're better than the other bands. And he's like, who cares about the other bands?
Right.
They're terrible.
Right.
Doesn't mean shit, basically. How would people know unless you show them? I mean, some people, you know, like those, the genius types who are actually super, super, super rare. Some of them will just have this inner thing where they just know. You shouldn't count on that or expect that. And definitely don't think that that's you. I think that's a huge mistake. Yeah. Most people just won't know unless somebody shows them.
Yeah. And that's why, I mean, I guess to toot our own horn, that's why I think one of the many reasons why I think Nail the Mix and Riff Art are so great is because there was no way to know before we came along. So for anybody who's listening that's not familiar, like if you sign up for nailthemix.com this month, you will get the actual raw multi-tracks to A Song by Monuments. And John Brown is one of the best fucking guitarists in metal, and his tracks are unreal. And like, if you want an example of what the highest standard looks like for a guitarist, he would be a perfect example of that. And now you can just go sign up to nailthemix.com right now for a dollar and you can see that. But 10 years ago, there was no way to get your hands on raw multi-tracks like that. And so you couldn't know really whether you were good. Like there's no way to directly apples to apples compare yourself to the best. But now, because of us and because of YouTube and lots of other things, you can compare yourself to the best. So I don't think that's an excuse anymore. I think now people, it's just ego. They don't want to admit that they aren't as good as the people that they look up to.
It's all subjective, man.
But it's not.
No, I know. I definitely don't think it is.
You're either fucking on the beat or you're not.
Yeah. I definitely think that back 10 years ago, there was a little bit more of an excuse. You're absolutely right. But I mean, how many multi-tracks have we put up now from amazing bands? Over 100.
Yeah.
Like there's no reason for why, you know, if you love Architects, which I know a lot of people do, and you want to sound like them, you can check out what they sound like without anybody else's studio magic. And if you do get that session, you realize their guitar playing is fucking unbelievable.
Yep.
And they sound great as they are, no matter what. And that's part of the whole thing. I think that there's this weird misconception that a lot of musicians have about what they're hearing coming, you know, through their speakers in their room when they're playing, or some idea between, I guess there's this like gap between what they're hearing on an album or a single or whatever, something finished, versus what they're hearing actually emanating from their speakers.
Right.
And they think that, I don't know, I feel like they don't quite see the gap as glare. Like they don't see it as glaring as it really actually is.
They're like, I'm not quite as good as Dimebag, but I'm pretty close.
Pretty close.
Like, no, you're not fucking even on the same fucking planet, because nobody is.
And with the right mixer.
Right. No, the best mixer in the world is not going to make me sound even 1% as good as him.
No, definitely not. It's really, really amazing when you've worked with enough great musicians and then heard the end product, and you start to recognize that what it sounds like is what they actually sound like.
Yes.
It's really weird.
Like Fluff had, when I went to his house last time, he actually had one of John Petrucci's guitars. And I don't know how he
sound
had
like him.
Yeah. I don't know how or why, but whatever, he had one. He's like, oh, it's John's guitar. I was like, all right. And I played it, and guess what? I didn't sound like John Petrucci.
Strange.
I know. Bizarre.
I wouldn't have expected that one.
Right. I didn't approve of the guitar, by the way. It's too small for John. It's I don't like those guitars. They're too small and round. It's one of those Ernie Ball, whatever they are.
Yeah, the tone was off.
Yeah, no, I just don't like the way it looks. I just don't approve of it.
Was it the one, like the really famous one with like...
I don't know. I don't remember. I think it was
yellow and blue and red. I don't remember.
But in any case, yeah. So I think that's, you know, ego to me is the biggest obstacle of most musicians. And I also want to talk about, speaking of subjective things that aren't subjective, songwriting. Let's talk about that, because almost everything that I know about songwriting I learned from you. And I think it has served me well as a critic, if you want to use that word. Songwriting is one of those things that people think is subjective, and to some extent it is, but a lot of it's not. You know, I think it's a cop out for people to say, like, if somebody with a good ear gives some criticism that says the song lacks dynamics, or there's no hook, or, you know, this melody is weak or whatever, it's a cop out. They're like, well, that's not what I was going for. And so to some extent, that might be true, but I think songwriting is more objective than people think it is. Can you talk a little bit about that, whether you agree or disagree?
I agree. I think that it's hard to put a finger on, which is why it's easy to fall into thinking it's subjective. And yeah, I guess technically you could say it is subjective because it comes down to people's tastes, but there's enough in common between songs that do really, really well, just like there's a lot in common between movies that tend to do really, really well, that it's not that there's a formula, but there's characteristics that tend
fundamental principles.
Yeah. That, I mean, sometimes there's rule breakers, but.
And everyone wants to think they're the rule breaker. Guess what? You're not.
Yeah. See, that's the
ego part.
Yeah. And also that's the part that, like, I guess subjectivity can come into, you know, when you hear like an 8 minute long song, that's a massive hit or that has no real structure to it.
Yeah.
Or a weird structure, and that happens. But since there's no way to predict that,
right,
and it's a totally odd outlier type of thing, I think it's kind of dumb. It's kind of dumb. If you want to
base your decisions off the fucking freak outlier versus the
really, really dumb
400 fucking thousand other songs that made it to, you know, the top 10 that all share the following things in common. But it's just a weird, it's that arrogance of so many musicians that they think they don't have to do things the way everyone else does. Like, it's okay for me to not change my strings. It's okay for me to not have a hook. It's like, who do you think you are? It's so odd.
Remember, there was this local band once. They rented my studio out with like an outside producer to do some sort of a film shoot. You were there. It was, you know, like a really nice looking drum room.
Yeah.
And they wanted to do some quote unquote unplugged thing with a bunch of acoustic guitars. And their vocals were so horribly out of tune. They had like harmonized vocals. And I remember walking through the room at some point where they were talking to each other.
Your glasses
and
like, cracked.
Yeah. Alice in Chains unplugged was out of tune. So it's fine.
Oh, okay. You're Lane Staley. I didn't know that.
Yeah, exactly. Totally not fine. But yeah, they told themselves that. And I've heard that sort of thing. You know, what's weird though about the ego thing is it's both the worst thing and the most important thing.
Yeah, right. Because it was okay when Lane Staley did it.
Yeah, it was. And you need enough ego to have the balls to put yourself out there.
Otherwise you just become one of these like boring, soulless Berkeley people that follows all the rules and has no ideas.
Yeah. It's really, really tough because when it works out and you do great things, you get praised for it. But then when you're hard headed with a stupid idea and you sound like shit, then everyone thinks you're an egomaniac.
So how do you know which group you're in?
You don't. Till the public decides, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's why you need a good producer. That's where the outsiders.
But I think you made such a good point is when the public decides, whoever that audience is. And, you know, obviously when you put out your guitar album, you didn't expect that to be able to win a number one hit. Like, you know, that only guitar nerds are going to like that. So you go into it with that understanding, but that's the part that's the real disconnect for me is like when people, like the thing you always hear from people like, well, I know my music's good. I just need more exposure. Like, well, what feedback do you have that your music is good? None.
And what kind of exposure? The exposure is already built into the way that music gets out there. If it's good enough, it'll expose itself.
You will at least get some inkling that it's good. You know, if you get 2 DMs a day from people you don't know saying that your music is great, you're onto something.
Yeah. And of course, there's a few things that'll fly under the radar that by luck of the draw, like some people will get that shitty luck or whatever, who will make music that if it was presented in the right context to the right crowd would do well. But since you can't predict that, it's counterproductive to worry about it. And also generally when people think their music's great and they don't do well, they suck.
Yes.
Generally.
Again, pretty much it's Occam's razor. Are you the one in a million who is like this underappreciated genius who just needs someone to shine the light on them and then they'll explode? Or
probably not.
Or is it more likely that maybe your music isn't as good as you think it is?
Probably
I know when I was making videos that I thought were great and I was frustrated that people didn't like them as much as they should, I went back years later and watched them. And I was like, yeah, that video is not very good. And I wonder people didn't like it.
Your videos have come a long way, by the way.
They have. And, you know, I wasn't afraid to suck for a while. I knew that I needed to improve. But again, to your point earlier, in my mind, the gap was not nearly as big as it was in reality. Like, I thought I sucked a little, but in reality, I sucked a lot. On the other hand, if I realized how bad I sucked, I might have just gotten discouraged and quit. So it is tough to manage that ego of like, sometimes it helps you, sometimes it hurts you.
What helped you ignore the, I guess, the feeling of wanting to quit, but then also ignore the feeling of maybe I'm delusional?
Well, I've been making stuff, you know, in one form or another for a very long time. So I sort of understand that it's part of the process, that there's going to be a part of this where you work really hard on stuff that nobody likes. And in hindsight, you look back and realize it sucks. Like, I just know that that's part of the process. So I accept it. You know what I mean? Just like anything, any craft that you want to get better at, there's ups and downs. There's some weeks where you feel like, holy shit, I'm a god, I've leveled up so much. And then there's other weeks where you're like, I am not getting any better. In fact, I feel like I'm getting worse. But you know that you just, you know, push through that. I guess for me, that's what keeps me going at any of these things. But I always try to be objective with myself about what's working and what's not, you know, like with people that leave me shitty comments, even if they're being fucking assholes about it. Sometimes they're right. You know, sometimes they're saying something shitty and rude that's still true.
I think that actually Misha said this to me a really long time ago, like when the first Periphery record came out the same day as Avalanche of Worms. And I emailed him to congratulate him on the release. And he said something to the extent of, I hope I don't agree with the bad reviews. Something along,
along
those lines. They might be right.
They might be right. Yeah, exactly. But getting back to songwriting, I want to talk about some of the fundamental principles that people should keep in mind that hold true regardless of genre, regardless of what your intent is. The one thing that we talked about, so we did a class together called Mastering Metal Songwriting, which is fucking awesome. Like, I still, with John Brown from Monuments and a bunch of other people, but I still like believe in that. I still think that's an amazing class. So anybody that wants to get better at songwriting, they have it on Creative Live. It's always on sale for like $15, as we've discussed.
Or $9.
Yeah, right. But it's great. One of the ideas in there that really stood out to me that helped me a lot was the idea of tension and release. Can you talk about that and what it means in the context of songwriting?
Yeah. So tension and release is, I think it's the main thing that you have in music that keeps it from being an even, unengaging experience. A lot like, I don't know if elevator music is still a thing or not. Mm-hmm. The thing about elevator music that was so terrible was that it was kind of the same even delivery, same even sound, and nothing is happening. And right. I actually think,
because it's just supposed to be background music. It's not supposed to be interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
But a song that you want people to care about, that's different.
Much like a movie, you need some sort of conflict and maybe some sort of resolution to the conflict, or at least some direction for that conflict to be going in. And I think that tension in music is a very, very similar thing. It's probably the same thing psychologically. Like, the way that we interpret conflict in a story is probably similar to how we look at tension in music. And so there's many ways to create it. You can create it harmonically. You can create it dynamically. You can create it tempo wise. There's lots of different ways to do it, but
what would be a good example of it from a song, like an artist, people like Metallica or something that people would know? Like a really good example of tension release.
So Master of Puppets in the verse where the first, I think it's the first two times through, he's on the low E string, down picking like a fucking maniac.
Yep.
And then they go up to the A string, which is a same riff, which is a super common technique to shift the key. But
it adds tension.
It just makes it feel like it stepped up a notch.
Like in pop songs, they'll go up a half step during like the second chorus or something.
Yeah, or the last chorus. Like I forget what Beyonce song. It's like they go through like seven different key changes in the last chorus, each one of them more and more tense than the last. It's a really, really great move. Muse will do it in their harmonic structure where the way that they'll build verses or pre-choruses is that towards the end, they almost always do this, towards the end of any awesome verse, the chords that they're outlining just get more and more and more tense up until the chorus, which is like a perfect resolution. And they'll build that into every aspect of their songs. So even within melodies that are within a stable sounding verse, the tension will just be built in. You can study this. That's one of the good reasons to learn music theory.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I mean, I know very little. Anything I learned is from you. And I felt like it was super helpful for me to learn just that small amount that I know was hugely helpful to me. But I know that you're also critical of people that, you know, learn too much. What is the right amount to know?
I don't know what the right amount is, but the people that I'm critical of are the people who aren't using the music part. They're just using the theory part,
right?
Kind of like a math problem. Now, the thing is that like in those Muse songs or that Metallica song or any great song, you could do the math equation afterwards, but the composer of the song was probably not doing an equation. They were probably just going by the way it felt. Anyways, two really good reasons to learn some theory. A, you want to communicate with other musicians on the planet and it's a common language, and fourth fret on the A string is super, super limited. If you want to do something beyond super bare bones music and actually get other people to interpret it or play it, you got to speak the same language. And that's kind of an accepted language. Another really good reason for it. And look, some people can do this without names for what they're hearing. So, you know, if you're that person, awesome. And there's plenty of great songwriters who know zero theory or great players like Mark Holcomb. He's a great player, knows zero theory, makes all kinds of complex chords and riffs in his parts, doesn't need it. But most people do need some way to name things that they're hearing. Like if they hear it in somebody else's song and they think it's a really, really cool chordal thing that happened, or it's really, really cool the way that this pre-chorus led into the chorus, whatever it is, it's really cool to have some sort of way to understand it and note it.
I wonder how many people, you know, there's lots of examples you could think of so-and-so is a great songwriter that doesn't know any theory and thinks theory is stupid and blah, blah, blah. Even with those people, I wonder how many of them, if they knew a little bit of theory, would be able to come up with these ideas a lot faster, or maybe even would be better. Like, it's almost like hunt and peck typing. It's like, yeah, you'll eventually type that book, but if you learned how to type properly, you'd type it five times faster and probably would be a lot more fun.
Also, the thing that is left out of the story a lot of the times with those musicians is who are they working with who does know their theory inside and out? Like, what producer or arranger or other band member who's not as famous is the one in that equation that does know the theory? Usually there's one or
that's
two
helping
or three.
To kind of smooth out the rough spots and make things fit together and,
facilitate the communication between people.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I think Jordan from Bring Me the Horizon is that person, for example, from what I understand anyway.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listenersurvey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
So what would you recommend that somebody learn? Like if they're like, okay, you're right, I probably should learn a little bit of theory. How much, what specific things would you suggest that they learn?
Not so much that they're basing their writing on it to where they feel like,
well, I can't use that note. That's not in the scale. Yeah.
When you're doing that, you've gone too far, I think. But I think to the amount where it helps you actually understand what's going on, whatever that is, it's going to be different for everybody. So there's some people that can, you know, get like a PhD level knowledge of theory and write amazing stuff too, like lots of soundtrack composers.
I'll give you a really basic example that for me was helpful when I was making some pop punk song years ago. There was one part of the song where I was like, oh, I feel like this song should be a little bit busier because the part before it was simple. Before, maybe I would have thought I should just write a whole new part, but instead I just arpeggiated the same part from before. So now it felt busier, you know, felt like there was more going on, but I didn't add unnecessary complexity to the song with a whole new part.
No need. That's also arrangement. Being really good at arrangement. I mean, it goes hand in hand.
But I just, I had a tool. I was like, yeah. There's a thing called arpeggiation and I can just use that.
That's exactly what it is a tool. Okay. So this is the subjective part, right? Is how much is the right amount? It's hard to say, but is it giving you that? Like, even if all you know is like this one tool of arpeggiating chords, but it helps you write a better song, then that's great. But I feel like if you're the person who's entering that formulaically because they don't know what the hell to do, that's probably not good. But
so if you're in a rock band, you probably don't need to be able to sit in on a session and they just tell you, oh, it's in this key and, you know, here are the changes. You probably don't need to be able to do that like some jazz player. But
you'd be amazed by how many people in big rock bands like I said, there's usually the one or the two.
That's true.
People.
That's true.
You'd be amazed by who knows their shit.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. I'm
constantly surprised by it.
I think about some of the people that I know who are, you know, the better musicians, and even like what you might think of as like a basic punk band. There are people like that.
Yeah. They, it's just, there's just this thing in heavy music. I don't think it's so much anymore, but there is this culture of pretending you're dumb that was popular for a while. And so I think lots of dedicated smart musicians just didn't advertise it. That kind of just got baked into the culture, but I feel like they've always kind of been there.
It's just strange that people are so resistant. Well, and it's not strange because it's work, because learning theory is boring and dry, and it's not as fun as sitting down and playing your favorite riff. So I understand why people don't want to learn it, but you know, in any creative field, I would encourage people to get good at the fundamentals, whatever they are in your field. And I think people who run away from that are just holding themselves back. That's my personal opinion.
The thing is, the people who I know who are good at it don't think it's boring.
Well, so that's true too.
Yeah. Like it's, so we get this question a lot, like how do I get motivated to practice or something? You know, that type of thing.
Right.
How do I get motivated to work on my mixing? It's like, well
I guess
you think Will Putney has to get motivated? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what to tell you.
I talked to John.
Mix, then don't mix.
Exactly. Petrucci was talking about this on the podcast we did with him. We brought that up and he's like, I've never needed to be motivated to play guitar. Why would I need to be motivated to play guitar? It's like, of course, John Petrucci doesn't need to be motivated to play guitar.
Right.
I think the theory thing is really, really similar. People that I've known that are really good at it, they do it because they want to understand how shit works.
Yeah. Like, you know, John Brown is a good example of that. He understands, he knows, at least to me, a pretty good amount of theory.
He does.
And he's not the kind of guy that, I mean, that's, if he's going to go down a rabbit hole, he's going to go all the way down that rabbit hole. But you know, you're not going to force him to do anything that he's not interested in. So, you know, that's, I think, a great example of it.
That's a very good example. He doesn't advertise it either, but he knows his shit.
Yeah, he does.
People that are under the age of 18 should take the advantage time-wise that they've got and study that shit. Most of the people, another thing that these great musicians tend to have in common, and not saying that, you know, if you're over 18 or over 35 or anything like that, that it's too late. But I'd say the majority of the ones that I've met, they got all that time in generally while they were in high school.
Right.
And then by the time they were adults, they were past it. So we know them as adults where they weren't learning theory anymore.
True.
They weren't really practicing. Well, they were practicing, but they weren't like approaching it like an intermediate or beginner player. Like it's already who they were. They're already fully formed. And so I think that among the professional musicians, it might get talked about a little less, but if you just go back 10 years, they were probably all about it.
Geeking out on it. That's probably
geeking out for years and years and years.
On the other hand, so the flip side of that is that there's also a thing in metal where people kind of fetishize this stuff in a way that makes no sense to me. Like the way people, like djent people, just sort of arbitrarily get fixated on things like polyrhythms. It's like, well, putting polyrhythms in a song is not going to necessarily make it a better song.
No.
Like just because the thing is somewhat advanced doesn't mean it's going to add to the song.
Yeah. It's kind of like sweet picking or something along those lines that is flashy and can sound cool, but is like a really like entry level thing that people that don't really have much musical taste gravitate towards.
Yeah.
But then you hear someone amazing use it, like Meshuggah and their polyrhythms. It's like, oh, this is what everyone's talking about. But
you see why I love Ale, because he's not afraid to say snobby things like that, that they have, like, he's not afraid to say that they have no taste. I'm not afraid to say it either, because I think that's exactly
it's not their
right.
fault.
No, it's not their fault. But I think that's exactly what it is that a lot of times people, and I mean, I'm sure that I have done it and probably continue to do it too. Like, anytime someone is new to a thing, they latch on to something that to them seems really cool and fancy and sophisticated. But to people that have actually been around for a while, it's like, oh yeah, I remember 15 years ago when I was really excited about that thing too. And to me, the lesson is like, look to the people who are where you want to be. This is this jujitsu is the same thing. Like, blue belts go through this phase where they get fascinated with all this like obscure, weird techniques that black belts never use. Look to the people who have achieved the things you want to achieve. And if they sort of roll their eyes at this thing that you're currently fixated on, that's something to consider.
Yeah, it's something to consider, but at the same time,
they might be, maybe they're missing it. On the other hand, like you said, they might be missing the potential of this thing.
Yeah, I don't want to discourage people from trying to get better, because most people that are great went through that time period, but then they just got past it. So I think you got to earn your snobbiness to a degree.
This is true too.
Yeah. Meshuggah and their polyrhythms, they're so good at that stuff because they went through being bad at it. Like, if you listen to their super early stuff, they weren't that great at it.
So, they're still better than 90% of bands will ever be, but yes.
Yeah, but they didn't really become themselves for a while.
Right.
So I don't want to discourage people from trying to get better, but taste isn't something that I think you're born with. I think you definitely have to develop it.
It's probably kind of an inevitable part of getting good at any kind of creative field, as you go through that Baroque phase where, you know, you get, I mean Baroque in the figurative sense, not the genre of classical music, the Baroque phase where you get into, like, you know, flourishy, fancy, ornamentational sort of stuff, you know, that your teachers all roll their eyes at you and tell you that that stuff's bullshit and you shouldn't care about it. But you're like, fuck you, it looks cool, or fuck you, it sounds cool.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember when I first started to figure out how to play fast, and it was new. It was new and it was cool sounding. And I was really impressed with myself. And I remember, again, my dad didn't give two shits. He thought it was like, it didn't even fucking matter. And now I see people play fast and, I do think it can be cool, but I also think it doesn't fucking matter. But if they didn't think it was cool at some point and didn't get excited by it, they probably wouldn't have stuck it out to get that great. It's really, really tough because I don't want to discourage people.
Well, playing fast is one of those things where if you want to hang your hat on that, you got to play really, 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 really fucking fast. You know, you got to be like Art Spire or, you know, Jason Richardson or something, where you play that shit for literally anybody and they're going to go, holy fuck, that is fast.
Yeah. But see, those Art Spire and Jason Richardson have this thing where they're actually playing good music.
That's true too. That's yes.
They're not just fast.
Going back to that Shrapnel Records stuff from the '80s, I don't think that stuff was good music for the most part.
No, most of it wasn't.
But just the fact that it was that fast and, you know, had that neoclassical shred kind of sound that was different was at least interesting at the time. Just, you know, I would consider that like experimental music. Did it hold up in hindsight? Kind of, sort of, not really.
Elements of it.
Yeah, exactly. But it was still cool. It was like a step on the journey to progressive metal as we think of it now.
Yeah. And also, I don't think that people before that understood how good you could get at the instrument, like what the virtuosic capability was.
Yeah. They redefined the envelope of how fast you could play, just like, you know, Art Spire and Jason did years later.
Yeah. Which is valuable. I think it might not be like, the most compositionally valid thing, but, you know, someone's got to define.
Well, Meshuggah redefined how tight you could play.
Yeah, exactly. And it sounds really cool when you're in the mood for it. I do think that you need those people, right, who are going to define what the technical limits are always. And I think that there's some people that that's their calling. Like, they're not they're not about writing good songs. Like, they might not even have it in them, but they have this insane physical ability that just needs to be expressed, and they help the rest of us.
Yeah, which I think goes back to kind of what you're talking about before, knowing your role in a band or on a creative team. Are you the virtuoso shredder? Are you the arranger? Are you the writer? These are not usually the same person, and they all have value. Like, the project won't turn out as well as it could without each of those people on the team. And so I think it's important to know who you are, and respect what everyone else brings to the table, knowing that none of us are more important than the other. We just each have our role to play.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really classic team up, right? The person that's much better at writing versus the person that's much better at playing. But, you know, the person that's much better at playing needs the person that's good at writing's material so that they have a platform to shine on. And then the person that's better at writing needs that really good player so that their material can sound good.
And that's, again, the ego, kind of the push and pull of ego, is like understanding when to defer to that other person. And then also understanding when to go, no, fuck you, this is how it should be.
Yeah, it's tough. Ego does get in the way. One of the things that lots of the people that I've spoken to who wish they were better at something else, like these insane shredders that wish they were better songwriters or vice versa, when you ask them what they spend their time on, it's like, it's no surprise that you're good at the thing you're good at and not good at the thing that you're not good at. And usually in the partnerships where people know who they are, that like, I love writing, I'll spend 8 hours a day on it, maybe an hour a day on technique. That's cool. Like, when there's those people, or, you know, the other person who's like, I just want to be an Olympic athlete on the instrument, and I might write 3 songs a year, but this person writes great shit. When those people have that self-understanding, self-awareness, and work together, those tend to be the best partnerships.
What would you say to somebody who is a, you know, we'll call it a one-person band, a solo, like a lot of people, it's like the solo musician, songwriter, producer, publisher, marketer kind of template of how people are now. What would you suggest to that person as far as working on their strengths versus shoring up weaknesses?
I think you could find really good arguments for both. It depends who you're listening to that day for which is the better idea. Like, you know, you can listen to Gary Vee at some point and hear about only focusing on your strengths. And then you'll hear Jocko talking about, you know, quirk on deepest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and who's right. They're both great.
Right.
And I think it's the same thing with musicians. I think that the great musicians have identified what their strengths are and leaned into those strengths, but they don't let their weaknesses
cripple them.
Yeah. That's pretty much it.
So, like, get your weakness to the point where it's not holding you back, and then build on top of that.
Yeah. It's something Wes Hawk said in the Q&A we did with him the other day that's super relevant, is there's not enough hours in your lifetime to address all of your weaknesses. Like, even if you live out a full, healthy, natural life, you're still going to maybe only get to 3% of them. And you're always going to feel like there's something left to do. So you should be selective about which one of those weaknesses you decide to focus on. And it should be in line with what your goal is.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, in either way, as long as you're working on something, that's probably time well spent.
Probably. Hopefully.
Yeah. Another thing in regards to practice that I was talking about with Dean from ArcSpire, we were talking about the idea of like the importance of deliberate, focused practice and not just sitting in your room and noodling and playing your favorite riffs and thinking that that's practice. But he brought up a really good point of like, yes, but also you have to enjoy this. So it's okay to let yourself noodle sometimes.
Yeah.
as sort of a way to bring the fun back to it, to if you're feeling frustrated. Can you talk about that balance? And again, kind of if you think about that as the balance between like healthy food and junk food, the balance of doing stuff that's fun on your instrument versus like practicing in a way that's not always fun?
Well, in a purely practical sense, if anyone who's written songs knows that the moment that you formally try to sit down and write a song is the moment you're out of good ideas. And then when you're not trying to do it is when the good ideas happen. And so just as part of being better, you kind of need to address both of those things. Like, you're not going to get better at your instrument when you're just sitting there fucking around. That's not when that happens. I think that's similar to working out. Like, you're not going to get stronger when you're sitting there working out. Going to get stronger when you're not working out. It's a similar sort of thing. You're not going to get better at guitar when you're sitting there fucking around. That's probably when you're going to come up with really good ideas, but you're probably not going to come up with the really good ideas when you're doing the formal practice. However, a well-rounded musician needs to do both. So it's important, I think, to build both in somehow, time-wise, and be cool with it.
Would you say that that's true for producers as well? Like, what's the equivalent for them?
Yeah. If they don't build that in somehow, you'll end up with those mixers that just, they hit this level and then just maintain forever.
Right.
Which, you know, it's fine if you're awesome, but even if you're really, really awesome, the public's going to move on eventually from your sound.
So right. And your clients and everyone else. Mm-hmm. And you sort of like, oh man, that guy used to be good.
Yeah. And he's probably still good for that time period.
Right.
So you need to keep redefining your boundaries, I think, as a mixer. It's a time management thing though, because you can't experiment so much that you're not going to get work done. So I think that the best mixers, the best producers have figured out for them how to build that in, whether it's during a session, like they just have this mental clock for how long they can spend on just playing out an idea, or it's after the session. Some people I know like will spend 15 minutes trying to learn a new technique after sessions, just as a discipline thing. It doesn't really matter. It's different for everybody, but the fact is the good ones are still doing that.
Yeah, just like the guitarist who shall not be named going back to the hotel and practicing for 2 hours after you filmed them for 8 hours.
Yeah, and I'm sure that during those hours, it wasn't scales to a metronome 100% of the time. I'm sure that some of it was just fucking around, watching TV, playing guitar, but that's okay.
And that is exactly why I thought I was so much better at guitar than I actually was, because that was my idea of practice. It's like watching TV and just like playing riffs. And I was like, I play guitar all the time. I practice a lot. Like, I'm pretty good.
I don't know a single guitar player who doesn't do that at some point. That's the thing. They also do all the discipline practice.
But if you ask me to play a major scale, I could do it, but not that well.
Major.
Yeah.
Who needs major anyways?
That's the only one I know. So.
I don't know how it relates to fighting or whatever, but I'm sure there's got to be some room for thinking on your feet.
Yeah. And it's the same thing as like drilling versus rolling. Like if all you do is roll, you're going to get better at what you already know at kind of, you know, implementing your A game, but you're not going to learn new shit. And if all you do is drill, then you're going to learn a bunch of, you know, you're going to be shallow but wide. You'll learn a bunch of shit, but you won't actually be able to apply it on a resisting opponent. So you got to do both.
I'm sure that the drilling part, the best fighters probably find a way to work that into their schedule, whether it's on their own
or
whenever the fuck it is, they do it.
Yep. Yep. You got to do both. It's the same thing, just like anything else. And, you know, whichever part you think is fun, that's cool, but you got to make sure that, you know, some people like drilling more than rolling and vice versa, but you know, whatever the fun part is of the thing that you're working on, that's cool, but you can't do that. You know, you can't let that be the only thing that you do, or else you'll end up like me, a delusional fool who dramatically overestimates their own ability.
Well, what's your goal though? right?
To be like, a mediocre slam guitarist.
If and that's
I achieved
your goal.
That goal.
I mean, no, for real though, if your goal is to be like the best
True.
In the world, then you got to do what the best in the world do. But if that's not what you're after, that's cool too.
Yeah.
You don't need to worry about all that shit, or right. at least not as much of that shit.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point too. It's like, you know, sometimes people ask me or anyone else like, well, you know, here's the way I do things. Is that okay? And the first question I would always ask is like, well, are you happy with where you're at?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, do you want to be the next John Petrucci on guitar? Some people do.
Yeah.
I don't think that Jason Richardson ever was divided within himself about trying to become the best guitarist on earth.
Right.
I'm sure that it was always that, but not everybody cares about that. Or
right.
some people think they care about that, but they don't actually care about that. I think if that's not who you are, it's good to know that too.
Yeah, that's a big one, which you've talked about quite a bit. And I am a believer in as well, is like making sure that your actions are aligned with your ambitions. You know, if you're saying you want to be the best in the world, are you acting like it? And if you're not, what do you do about that? Maybe the answer is admitting to yourself, you know what, I'm okay with not being the best in the world because, you know, John Petrucci naturally practices 8 hours a day or whatever it is. I have to force myself to practice 90 minutes a day. How do I reconcile these things?
Get over yourself, basically.
Yeah, somehow. One way or the other.
Yeah.
One way or the other, you know, either suck it up and practice more, or maybe being a virtuoso guitarist is not your calling.
Which is fine.
Yeah, people think that this is harsh. You know, I guess both of us are kind of blunt about the way that we say these things to people, and maybe it comes off as harsh sometimes, but it's not harsh. It's just like, it's just coming to terms with reality one way or the other.
I think it's liberating, not yeah, harsh.
Exactly. Instead of being trapped in this scenario where you feel forced to do, you know, you're pulled in one direction with your mind, but your body is doing another thing. It's like, you can't be pulling yourself in two different directions. You're going to be miserable.
Yeah. It's important to not use that as a cop-out though, which I think some people do. They sell themselves yeah. short, but you're not going to become the best in the world at something if you don't actually want to become the
exactly.
best in the world.
Like if you have to drag yourself kicking and screaming into the gym or into practice or whatever it is, like that's okay. Like most people don't enjoy doing scales 4 hours a day. Like that's okay.
No, I don't think they do. If they have to fight themselves to do it, they're sure as hell not showing anybody
right.
that they're fighting themselves to do
that,
it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If there are people out there who like that is really legitimately what they want to do. There's people, I mean, I have trained with jiu-jitsu people that will just fucking drill one thing for 2 hours. You know, I find that boring, and that's the reason why they're better than me, and that's okay. Like just, you know, knowing who you are is the important part.
I remember reading an interview with The Edge from U2.
What is his real name, by the way?
I have no idea.
Because that's what I'm going to call him, like Brian. Like, is it cool if I call you Brian?
It's probably Brian.
Yeah. Can I call you Brian? Is that all right?
Nobody knows his name. He was talking about how there's this intro to some song that they were playing on whatever stadium tour they were on, and he was having trouble with that. So every day before soundcheck, you get up on stage for 2 hours exactly and practice the same 2-chord intro.
Fuck. Which
it's not virtuosic material.
Yeah.
But still hard to do anything well. And I think he probably understood that he's not going to be the greatest guitar player on earth, but probably decided that he'd want to be the greatest guitar player playing that part at that time.
Yeah.
He was focused on that.
Yeah.
All right, my friends, that does it for this episode of the podcast. If you made it this far, thank you. Thank you for listening. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. If you want to help the show, there's a couple things that you can do. First of all, share it on social media. If you share it, tag us, tag Finn McKenty, that's me, and tag Deanna Chapman, that's a producer. Second thing you can do, if you really, really, really love us and really want to support us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to this, or you can do none of that. And you can just sit at home thinking about how awesome this podcast is. That works too. Again, thank you very much to each and every one of you for listening. We sincerely appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.